Thank you. Welcome to the January-February meeting of the New England Council. Usual housekeeping items. We will try and take a break every 90 minutes. Cell phones on buzz or whatever. I'll probably be the first offender. I finally got one of these smartphones, and it's generally smarter than I am, and I'm not sure I've been able to silence it, but I've tried. Are there any changes or additions to the agenda as sent out? Seeing none. Under introductions, I would like to take this opportunity to introduce Bill Karp, who is the acting director of the Science Center. Bill comes to us from the Alaska area. He ran the North Pacific Observer Program, and he was the deputy director of the Alaska Science Center. Bill, we look forward to working with you while you're here. And if you'd like to say a few words.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the introduction. I'm pleased to be here. I'm looking forward to the meeting and getting to know all of you. The issues are clearly a little bit different than the ones that I'm used to, so I'm on a very steep learning curve. But please feel free to come talk to me if there's anything on your mind about the science. And again, I'm looking forward to working with all of you for the time that I'm here.
Thank you. We'll jump right into the reports. First is my report. I will go essentially through some of the highlights of the executive committee meeting. That's under tab one, under correspondence and reports. It's number two is the summary of the executive committee meeting. I won't spend a great deal of time on those items that we're actually going to discuss during this meeting over the next few days. Under one was the timelines and management actions. We had a discussion on this and made a decision to post on the website the timelines. And essentially, the way they got posted would be the baseline for timelines, and every subsequent change to the timelines would be indicated, and it would be indicated on there what the reason for that change was. That allows everybody to get a better understanding of where we are moving each management action through the system. We had a discussion concerning a request for hosting the national SSC meeting here and also discussed a two-day council meeting with the SSC for a workshop on risk, and made a decision that since we had limited staff capabilities that we would go with the SSC and Council two-day workshop on risk. So we will continue to work on that. Also, it was decided that the Council chair would sit at the SSC table, and in cases where there was a discussion on a species FMP, that a decision being made by the SSC, the appropriate committee chair would also sit at the table. As I indicated at the last SSC meeting, we're not there to question people on the science. We're there to help inform them about the council's desires concerning the terms of reference, et cetera. We had a discussion on this fisheries forum a la carte. The idea was that we might be able to get assistance from the fisheries foreman forum on some of the workshops that we would be doing here. No final decision was made on that, although we were leaning towards getting them involved in helping us with the discussion on risk tolerance. The next one is the item four for the National Northeast Region Regional Ocean Council. That just in, there's going to be a workshop in March, and the council members will get the invitations for that. Under five, the discuss better interaction between the committee and APs. The executive committee had a discussion on getting the AP chairs to be seated at the committee table for initially for discussion purposes. We still have not come to a conclusion as to whether those AP chairs would have a vote on the committee. It's indicated in here, but that's not a final decision. We will discuss that and make a final decision on that at the next executive committee meeting. We jump down to we had a presentation from the Nature Conservancy's Northwest Atlantic Marine Eco-Regional Assessment. There was nothing directly on that. The Gulf of Maine, COD, SSC, and the terms of reference. Obviously, we're going to be getting to that on tomorrow. Paul, are you going over the one on the work plan and priorities? Is that part of yours? Yeah. That is the from the executive committee. I wanted to bring up one other item. I have received comments from members of the public concerning the process for public comment on motions being taken up by the council. I was asked whether I would continue to have the policy that I used at the last meeting, which essentially is to have public comment taken up front, and then when the discussion comes back to the council for its vote, that it would not go back and forth. It would stay at the council for until the vote was taken. I indicated that yes, I would continue to do that, primarily because I felt that when we have the discussion up front, it makes a better flow of how the council acts on that. It is also this is not something that I just made up as an arbitrary rule. It is the process outlined by Robert's Rules of Order, and even they indicate that it allows for a more efficient flow of motions. That being said, rules are made to be broken, and when I see a situation that things have changed enough during the discussion, I may well open it back up for public comment. But in general, I think the public should understand that I would like to have the public comment up front, bring it back to the council for council discussion and resolution of the motion. That's all I have. Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Vice Chairman Jim Ottle and myself attended a two-day, three-day Council Coordinating Committee meeting in Washington, D.C. I want to give you a little brief about what went on there. That was last week. Our 2012 budget was finally approved. The overall NIMS budget received a $24 million reduction, which is not bad, and our share of that is $113,000. So we're funded at the 2011 level minus $113,000. That is much better than what is anticipated for 2013. 2013, they're talking about what was already passed by Congress, $1 trillion discretionary cap will be in place, and there's talk of the federal government going to the 2009 budget level, which would be very bad for us, and starting with that, the 2009 level. So luckily, we are on a five-year budget where we can roll over funds for 5 years. We are in the third year of that rollover, third year of that five-year budget. The federal government doesn't have that luxury of carrying over money like we do. So I've carried money over in 2010 and 11 in preparation for bad budget times, and I think they're going to come in 2013. But for 2012, we're aces. We're doing very well. Also mentioned at the meeting was the IG review of NOAA rulemaking. It's a national review that's starting this week. NIMS has gotten in touch with the IG auditors, and there hasn't been any official response or dialogue between NIMS. So we know it's beginning. We don't know where it's going to start, whether it's going to start on the West Coast or East Coast, but there will be a review of the rulemaking process beginning this week. Touchstone report, as you know, we've been working on that. Phase two is about to start on the Touchstone report, where that group will be going out and interviewing people, looking at the progress we've made with the Touchstone report, and trying to broker an operating agreement between the councils and the National Marine Fisheries Service. You might have seen the press releases that the regional fishery management councils are now part of the regional planning bodies. That is good news. The councils petitioned long and hard to be part of that national ocean policy where we could be involved in the trade-offs. I expressed some concerns at the CCC that our representative on those bodies has to be a state or federal government official. So representing the councils will have to be a state director or the regional administrator. And I express concern that that may be very difficult for a state employee to go against what the governor wants for his particular state. So I have concerns about our representation on these regional planning bodies and having these bodies really take a regional focus when it's, entirely state planning efforts. MRIP numbers are out, and we'll discuss that more tomorrow. But the general statement is the numbers we were using with MRFs overestimated what the actual catches were. The new MRIP numbers that are more accurate has the recreational catches for cod and haddock at a much lower level than the MRF's estimates. Timelines, Rip discussed. We submitted our herring DEIS on Monday, January 23rd. It was our official submission. We will be holding public hearings, and then the council will vote on the final herring plan at our April council meeting. Mark your calendars. The NROC regional workshop will be held March 12th and 13th. I am on the planning committee for that regional workshop. Three SSC members, the chairs of our advisory panels, and each council member will be invited to that two-day workshop. It will be held at Roger Williams Law School in Bristol, Rhode Island. You are encouraged to attend. And the last thing Rip mentioned was the XCOM priorities. You'll hear from the regional administrator that there's an important endangered species listing coming up that is definitely going to impact our workload. We've got ecosystem issues going on where we've established an ecosystem committee, and the MID is going to be part of that, and we also have an NRCC new governance coordinating work group looking at governance issues with ecosystem management across highly migratory species, state fisheries, and mid-Atlantic coordination. So there's a number of things going on between Gulf of Maine cod, endangered species listings, and ecosystem management that I've asked the executive committee, will probably meet in February, to take a harder look at priorities. Things are growing. So that's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Paul. Questions? Dave, and then Dave.
Okay. Paul, I'm glad to hear that we're going to have a representative at the Ocean Council. But what you said, if I heard right, was it can only be a federal or state employee. That means it can't be council staff or council members who are not. Is there a law that has governed that, or is that just a policy that they've made, or is there any chance of changing that?
We discussed this at length at the CCC meeting, and the council folks feel like because we're covered under FACA that it should be all right for a council member to be on there. But I think the lawyers have looked at it every which way but loose and believe that it's got to be a state or federal employee to satisfy the FACA. None of us agree with that, but that's what they're saying.
Within the executive committee report, there are there's a reference to Gulf of Maine cod, and there's also the memo that goes from Paul to the executive committee on Gulf of Maine cod. And I note in the report under item number 8 that it says, in January, the council uses that information regarding the SSC review and the peer-reviewed cod assessment. We use that information to ask NIMS to take an emergency action to adopt an interim catch level and appropriate measures for fishing year 2012. So my question is, at this meeting, are we going to discuss and then offer up potentially management measures to be in place relative to Gulf of Maine cod for the coming fishing year, or consistent with what I think you said at a previous council meeting, there might be a special council meeting to deal specifically with management measures for Gulf of Maine cod. So that's the question. What exactly has the executive committee offered up to the council for guidance on this issue?
Well, the answer is we are going to deal with it at this meeting tomorrow, primarily tomorrow afternoon. The recommendation for emergency action and whatever measures we will suggest that NIMS incorporate into that emergency action. There essentially is not enough time for us to have a subsequent meeting and allow the service enough time to put the measures in place by the 1st of May. Anyone else? Okay, we'll move along to the regional administrator, George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to start out by making an introduction also. As you all know, I think Pat Kirkle retired at the end of December. And acting as regional administrator is Dan Morris, who's in the audience today. And he will be acting in that position while the search goes on for a replacement. And also, he'll be here for a couple of days, I think, so please take the opportunity to say hello, get to know him. Also, acting in Dan's real job, the deputy regional administrator, is Sarah Malloy, who is from the Pacific Islands Center, and she's here on a detail to help out in the interim. I have a number of things to report on. At the end, I've got a couple of things. As the chair mentioned, we have a new listing under ESA that we need to take a little bit of time to go over. So I'll save that to the last item on my report. Under multi-species, at your November council meeting, you asked that the secretary initiate an emergency action to increase the Gulf of Maine winter flounder, ACL, for the remainder of this fishing year. I think we're very close to having a final decision made on that, so we should see something very soon on that. On multi-species amendment 17, we published the notice of availability. This is the permit bank, addressing some of the permit bank issues. The notice of availability was published in the Federal Register on December 12th. The proposed rule that would implement Amendment 17 was published on December 22nd. The comment period on the proposed rule closed January 23rd, and on the amendment, that comment period will close February 10th. Following the comment period, we will address and consider the comments and prepare the final rule. We also published a notice of availability and a proposed rule for the secretarial amendment for the small mesh multi-species, aka whiting fishery, in the Federal Register on December 23rd. And the comment period on that amendment closes on February 21st. You may recall this is basically a temporary action we're taking to put in place the ACLs and AMs while the council completes its work on Amendment 19. The Days at Sea leasing program, some statistics for you. For the period May 1, 2011 through January 26, 2012, total leases processed from the common pool were 22. Of those, 15 were approved. And in sectors, 227 leases were processed, and of those, 158 were approved. The total number of days at sea leased were 268 in the common pool and 4,974 in sectors. The average cost per day at sea leased was $134.78 in the common pool and $21.70 for sectors. In terms of sector ACE transfers, through that same period through January 26, there were a total of 934 transfers amounting to 14,500,816 pounds. Under scallops, we published a proposed rule for Framework 23 on January 3rd, and the comment period closed on January 18th, and we're currently developing the final rule for Framework 23. The new cost recovery program for the limited access general category scallop IFQ fishery, the first year of that ended on September 30th. Cost recovery bills were sent out in November, and payments were due January 1st. The bills amounted to 0.2948% of the ex-vessel value of any IFQ scallops that were landed during the fee period. In other words, basically 0.3%. As of last week, 94% of the bills have been paid. So I would call that a success for the first year. Under Atlantic herring, we published a proposed rule in the Federal Register on December 22nd that would reduce the 2012 ACLs for the herring fishery to account for overages in areas 1A and 1B in 2010. The comment period on that closed January 6th, and we're currently considering the comments, and we'll prepare a final rule for that. All right, that's the more standard fare. I want to make you aware that on January 13th, we sent to you a letter to the chairman from Dan Morris asking that the council help to clarify the applicability of rockhopper and roller gear restrictions that were first established by the council in 1999 under Framework 27 to the groundfish FMP. This recently came up as an enforcement question as to whether it applied to gears other than those on vessels that were permitted for groundfish. In consultations between my staff and yours, it was decided that the best course of action was to come back to the council and ask for clarification. The regulations as written are generic. They would, on their face at least, apply to any gear fished in that area of the Gulf of Maine. But the economic analysis in Framework 27 was based only on ground fishing. So we need a clarification of the council's intent and then decide whether we need to make those regulations more specific to ground fish or whether they should be generic. In the meantime, they're not; those regulations are not being enforced. Yeah.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. A quick question. How is it enforced now? I mean, we've got a number of priorities. I think this was on the ground fish committee to look at, and we've got a number of things to do. So I was wondering what happens in the meantime before you get this determination. What's the rule?
Logan may want to add to this, but based on what I have, this came up under the northern shrimp fishery in the Gulf of Maine. And during this interim period, patrols are going to document vessels that are in compliance and those that are not in compliance with the regulations as written. But there won't be any trips terminated and there won't be any violations issued this season while we try to figure out how these regulations were intended to apply. Logan, do you want to add anything?
That's pretty much correct. There's no intent to keep anyone from fishing in the shrimp fishery for this rock hopper regulation until it's clarified. What we want to do is get sort of a baseline as to the number of fishermen that are using them and those that aren't, and that'll give us an idea of what we have. When the time does come, as a determination is made on the regulation, what our picture looks like and enforcement for that.
That's your question? Okay, thank you. Moving on to our potpourri here, we have something on seabirds. Yesterday, Acting Assistant Administrator Sam Rauch sent to all the councils a draft memorandum of understanding between NOAA Fisheries Service and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for the conservation of migratory birds, and asked that the councils review the draft and provide comments. This is an outcome of Executive Order 13186, which was issued in January 2001 under the Clinton administration, actually, that requires federal agencies that take actions that have or are likely to have a measurable negative effect on migratory bird populations, and this applies to seabirds, to develop and implement a memorandum of understanding with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to promote conservation of migratory bird populations. Both agencies have prepared that draft, and that was sent as an attachment to Sam's memo to the council, so hopefully you'll have an opportunity. I think you haven't, April 13th, so you have some time to look through that to see if you have any comments. The draft MOU encompasses all relevant seabird-related NIMS activities and identifies specific areas of collaboration and cooperation with Fish and Wildlife Service, including seabird bycatch reduction, information sharing and coordination, international policy and diplomacy, and habitat conservation. Of particular importance to the councils is Section 4A, which focuses on seabird bycatch reduction and emphasizes the need for both agencies to work with the councils to incorporate seabird bycatch reduction measures in FMPs as appropriate. So please, when you get an opportunity to look at that, do so and provide any comments you might have to us. The comment should be returned to Kim Rivera. Contact information is in the letter. She's our National Seabird Coordinator. And finally, I'd like to talk about Atlantic sturgeon. As I think many of you know, the final decision regarding the proposed listing of Atlantic sturgeon along the Atlantic coast under the Endangered Species Act has been expected and is due to be published, I believe, later this week. But in any case, NOAA Fisheries is announcing the findings of that now. There are five distinct population segments of Atlantic sturgeon, which you can think of basically as equivalent to fish stock. on the East Coast. And of those five, the Gulf of Maine population is being listed as threatened, and the other four, New York Bight, Chesapeake Bay, Carolina, and South Atlantic, are being listed as endangered. Listing as endangered is intended to provide protections to avoid extinction, and listing as threatened is intended to provide the population from becoming endangered, in other words, getting in worse condition than it already is. Once the rule is published, there will be a 60-day delay in effectiveness. In other words, the listings won't be in effect for 60 days. And these listings will have impacts on some of the Atlantic Coast fisheries, including some of those managed by both of our councils, New England and Mid-Atlantic, although those impacts are not absolutely defined yet. We're still working on the data that will give us better information on specifics there. One thing you should know is that the five populations migrate and mix at sea. So the fact that the Gulf of Maine stock is not endangered doesn't mean that there won't be fish from the endangered DPSs that occur in the Gulf of Maine. It's one of the complications of this management. They can show up widely apart from their natal river. It's already illegal to fish for, catch, or keep an Atlantic sturgeon in U.S. waters, but they are incidentally caught in some fisheries. And although there are no specific bycatch reduction measures in place, no fishery has been working with the industry and the center to develop bycatch reduction methods and gears. So we do have some information on some gear modifications that may be helpful in addressing this listing. Of particular importance to the councils is the fact that due to these new listings, we are reinitiating Section 7 consultations under the ESA on several fisheries, including groundfish, monkfish, skates, I believe, spiny dogfish, perhaps others. And the fisheries that are likely to have the greatest impacts and therefore be most impacted by measures that we will have to consider to address these listings are the sink gillnet fisheries, particularly monkfish, skate, spiny dogfish, and groundfish. So, as I said, there's a 60-day delay in the effectiveness, but in the meanwhile, our Protected Resources Division is developing biological opinions as a result of the new Section 7 consultations. And as part of that, they will be developing reasonable and prudent alternatives for the endangered DPSs that are feasible and that will reduce takes to levels that will avoid jeopardy, which is critical for the fisheries to continue. We are also going to engage the councils, both the Mid-Atlantic and New England Council, as soon as possible to get their input and advice on measures that could be adopted to avoid jeopardy in the case of the endangered stocks and to minimize takes of sturgeon for all of them. If the consultation indicates that there is jeopardy, then we have to find reasonable and prudent alternatives to establish to avoid jeopardy and to allow fishing activity to continue. And if the consultation finds no jeopardy, then reasoned prudent measures, RPMs, are identified to minimize takes, but that can have no more than minimal impacts on the fisheries. And that's, at this point, all I have. There's a lot of details, I'm sure, in the rules when they come out as to how the determinations were made and specifics of each DPS. But I wanted to make you aware of that so that we can start working together with our protected resource people and my staff and yours to get a head start on this. Thank you.
Thank you. Just before we go to the questions for George, I wanted to make a suggestion concerning the migratory bird MOU. Since we just got it yesterday, it's a 16-page document. My suggestion is that the executive committee and staff prepare a response to that. I just don't think we're going to have time to digested and do that here at this meeting. So I'll suggest that without objection. Okay, thank you. We will do that for the MOU. Now, questions. Start with Terry and then David.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. George, do you have any guidance on the timeline for implementation of either the RPMs or RPAs?
Yeah, that's a complicated question. As I said, they're 60 days before they're actually listed. The intent is to get the biological opinions in place either on that date or as soon as possible so that we have some coverage under the ESA that indicates that we are taking appropriate action. There is no, to my knowledge, there is no statutory time frame in which the RPAs and RPMs have to be implemented, although obviously we have to show a good faith effort that we are taking it seriously and have a plan. But there is no 60, 90, 120-day completion date. But we have to be able, in the interim, we have to be able to make the finding that we are doing the right things and the populations aren't going to suffer unduly while we're taking the time to put in place the measures.
David.
Yeah, thanks, George. How does NIMS intend to work with the states to deal with this issue relative to staging? Do you have a plan in terms of some direct interaction? Because obviously states have bottom-tending gillnet fisheries in their waters that would be impacted by this. So what's the intent?
Okay. I'll have a crack at this, but this isn't my area of expertise, so I think we have to have further discussion. My understanding is that any federally permitted vessel, anything that's managed through a federal action will be covered by the incidental take statements, assuming there are some, and the biological opinions. However, if there are individuals or state fishermen who don't have federal permits, they will not be. So they will be subject to the Section 9, I believe, measures that prohibit take. And to address that, I think either the state agencies need to work with the agency to consult, or the individuals do. But that's as far as I can go. That's the shallowness of my knowledge on that subject at this point. We'll, I think, need to talk more about that.
Okay, it doesn't seem too shallow to me. Right, well, certainly you're well aware of the issues, so I anticipate that there will be some communication with the different states so we can work together on this important issue. You mentioned Gulf of Maine winter flounder and indicated that you're close to a final decision very soon. You can't say when soon would be, right? I only asked that question because we were at a scoping hearing last night dealing with Amendment 18 to the groundfish plan, and there was at least one comment made in a private conversation relative to what's going on. It should happen quickly. Some sectors are in trouble, or at least some members within sectors are in trouble, and they're waiting with bated breath for these numbers to go up. So anything more than very soon, middle of February, next week?
I can't say, and partly because I simply don't know. I can tell you it's well along, and everyone all the way up the chain is well aware of the urgency. So it's got people's attention, but exactly when, I couldn't say.
Okay, great. That's good news. And one other question. Let's see. The spiny dogfish, the New England Council, and the Mid-Atlantic Council have adopted a specific quota for the next fishing year. And ASMFC has adopted a lower number. When last we discussed spiny dogfish, Pat Kirkle was, well, I wouldn't say noncommittal, but I sort of got the feeling that she was going to do what she wanted to do. That is, go with a lower number.
Has the service made a decision as to what will be the federal quota for the upcoming fishing year?
No. That's still in consideration, but it's not ready for announcement at this point. There will be a proposed rule for the specifications that will be coming out before long.
Okay, just one warning of sorts. ASMFC meets next week, and Dogfish is on the agenda. It's possible there might be a reconsideration of the decision that ASMFC made in Boston a while ago because of what the New England Council and the Mid-Atlantic Council did. So if NIMS is moving forward to implement the lower quota to be consistent with ASMFC, just be aware that that may not necessarily be the quota that is eventually adopted by ASMFC. It may be revised, maybe not, but just be aware of that. Thanks.
Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. George, I understand there's 4 fisheries, groundfish, monkfish, skates, dogfish, that will be impacted by the listing. Now, do we get a separate biological opinion for each of those fisheries? And if we get a separate biological opinion, which means separate measures to implement, can we get these all at once so that we can take a holistic look at seasonal closures and everything like that across those 4 fisheries?
There may be other fisheries besides those 4, just let me tell you. But those, I think, are the ones that are most likely to have some significant issues. The answer is yes, they will be separate biological opinions for each of the fisheries. The timing, I know that the intent was to get them all done at the same time. I'm not sure that's going to be possible. I think they're going to get them done as close together as they can. I think they'll be close enough together that going forward won't really be that problematic since we don't have to do anything immediately. But I will pass that on to the folks who are doing the opinions so they're aware of your concern.
Frank.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, George, I know the comment period is closed. This might be a better question for tomorrow, but just something to think about. The AMs for haddock and the new MRAP data showing that the catch is probably about half of what it was. So is there a chance that they may be repealed or something may be different?
Well, we did talk about that, actually. At the time that the AMs were established and at the time the AMs were triggered, we, of course, only had the MRFs data. So that's what we went by. It probably is something we should talk about more tomorrow, and Sam will be here tomorrow. There is the possibility we could do something to reverse that, but our first priority is going to be dealing with Gulf of Maine cod and whatever we have to do with that. So let's just leave it there for today.
Anyone else on the council? Dave.
Yeah, George, on the sturgeon, is a take any interaction, is it the same definition of take throughout the Endangered Species Act?
Yes, I think it is, and it's broad. It's harassing, catching, handling, certainly killing, harming. It's a very broad definition. Basically, any interaction that could cause the animal any distress is comes
so
under
this,
that.
So this has the potential to, as an example, harm, you know, shipping up the Hudson River or, I mean, anything like that. I mean, that clearly must stress the sturgeon out when you run a super tanker over it. So, I mean, what I'm getting at is that perhaps in the biological opinion it would be a good idea to more narrowly define take. I mean, these are pretty hardy animals. I mean, I had one years ago when I was gilding that, and we spray painted a name on his side. He got to be a pet. He came up every day for weeks, and you know, we kept letting them go. That would definitely be a take. I understand that under this definition. But, you know, my point is that they were, you know, quite hardy. You know, maybe the traditional definition of take needs to be looked at here.
I don't think that's an option because take is defined in the Act. So it's a statutory definition. We couldn't do anything through a biological opinion that would change that. But you're correct in that, you know, the impacts of this go beyond fisheries. It goes dredging projects or shipping or you know, water quality, anything that would impact the species, and it's ultimately its critical habitat once that's designated could be impacted by these listings.
Paul?
Just a basic question. This obviously is based on science. When was the last stock assessment, and who manages sturgeon?
I don't remember when the last stock assessment is. I could probably look it up for you, and I'm sure it's in the rules, but I don't know offhand. As far as who manages it, I believe ASMFC has a sturgeon plan, and I think they also prohibit any retention capture as we do in federal waters.
Anyone else on the council? I will go to the audience on this. Anybody have a question for George on that? Okay. Thank you, George. NOAA General Counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just some report on the status of the two challenges to Amendment 16 to the Groundfish FMP. In the what I'm calling the New Bedford case, it's the challenge by primarily industry representatives of Amendment 16, which the agency prevailed on at the district court level. That case, as I've reported previously, has been appealed by several groups of the original plaintiffs. The briefs by those plaintiffs or appellants have been filed, and the government's brief is due on February 29th. This is based on an extension of time that the court granted. So that's a brief that we're working on now, and it's hard to predict when the appellate court will have a decision after February 29th. It can be quick. It can be long. It's totally in the hands of the appellate court. The other challenge to Amendment 16 was by Oceana. It was filed in Federal District Court in District of Columbia. We did receive a decision on that on December 20th. Of last year. Essentially, the court found on all counts except one for the agency that the partial adverse ruling had to do with whether there was adequate accountability measures, essentially sub-accountability measures for five stocks of fish in the context of sector provisions. Those five stocks of fish were Atlantic halibut, ocean pout, windowpane flounder, southern New England mid-Atlantic winter flounder, and Atlantic wolf fish. Now, for all but Atlantic halibut, there was a zero possession limit established, which was billed as a prospective accountability measure. For Atlantic halibut, there's a one fish landing limit allowed. And those accountability measures only were prospective. There was no reactive accountability or sub-accountability measures established for those stocks. In other words, Amendment 16 did not have specific accountability measures applicable to sector vessels that would result in measures if the ACLs for those stocks were exceeded. The court found that the lack of that kind of an AM, of what the court and what we argued in our brief would be styled as a reactive AM, that the lack of reactive AMs did not comply with national standard guidelines and the Madison-Stevens Act, and the court remanded that issue back to the agency and to the council to address. Now, Framework 47 was intended to develop reactive type of AMs, or at least adequate AMs for those five stocks. That framework, of course, has been approved by the council and is being prepared to be formally submitted to the agency. So the agency will have to evaluate Framework 47 to determine whether they have fixed this problem that the court has found. And if not, then it will be necessary for the agency, the council, to develop sub-accountability measures for those five stocks that meets the court's finding. Now, the other issues that were in play in this lawsuit, issues that were brought up by Oceana, included an issue or a claim that Amendment 16 did not provide for adequate performance standards for monitoring bycatch in order to administer the ACL AM system that Amendment 16 put into place. The court on that issue found that the requirement for establishing ACLs and AMs did not have a separate specific requirement for establishing a standard for monitoring bycatch. The court recognized that there had to be an adequate system for monitoring bycatch, but it did not rise to the level of the SBRM type of monitoring program that the plaintiffs argued for. So the court found, in essence, that the Amendment 16 did not violate this claim that there was an inadequate performance standard for monitoring bycatch and found in favor of the agency. The court also found, the Oceana also sued, claiming that the amendment failed to establish accountability measures for yellowtail flounder caught in the scallop fishery. The agency successfully argued that Amendment 15 in the scallop fishery did establish adequate accountability measures, and for that reason, the court held that it could not fault Amendment 16 because there was a subsequent action and with respect to the scallop fishery that established those accountability measures. Oceana also claimed that Amendment 16 under NEPA failed to take a hard look at the environmental impacts of including or excluding stocks from the catch limit system, and this had to do with whether there needed at least to be an analysis of whether other stocks that may be incidentally caught in the multi-species fishery but are not specifically managed by the fishery need to be subject to the catch limit system. The court held that there was a sufficient analysis of this issue, essentially the council had discretion as to which species were considered species of the fishery and therefore which ones were subject to catch limit system. The court, Oceana also alleged that Amendment 16 under NEPA failed to consider alternatives or sufficient alternatives to the ABC control rule other than the no action alternative. And the court here also found that there was a sufficient analysis of the ABC control rules and reasonable alternatives, and therefore held in favor of the agency and the council, in essence. So where this leaves us now is what I alluded to earlier, and that is the court has remanded to the council and the agency as follows. The court said, Amendment 16 fails to establish sufficient accountability measures for five stocks in the multi-species fishery. The court then goes on to say that the issue of establishing accountability measures for the five stocks is remanded to NIMS and the council for further action consistent with the opinion. And I think we will be giving more specific guidance on how to respond to that remand as we review Framework 47 to determine to the extent that it actually fulfills this remand already, and whether any additional actions might be necessary by the Council and the timing for those actions. And that concludes my report, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Gene. Question? Dave Gaethel.
Gene, do you intend to appeal the section of the case that you lost on?
We are discussing that now with Department of Justice, and we don't have a final conclusion on it. I will point out that the court's finding with respect to these sub-ACLs and AMs essentially mirrored what we put in our letter in the partial approval amendment 16, which was we acknowledge that there may be a necessity to develop sub-AMs for these stocks and ask the Council to address that, and that is, in fact, what is being done in Framework 47. So we don't see the court's decision as necessarily establishing a bad precedent, but the final decision on appeal has not yet been made.
Anyone else? Thank you, Gene. Okay. Is it Jim or Bill on this one? Jim?
I'll be giving the report on Science Center activities. First, on surveys by our ships. For upcoming surveys, the 2012 spring bottom trawl survey will be conducted in four legs beginning on February the 28th and ending on May the 5th with the Bigelow. The 2012 scallop, a dredge survey, will be conducted in three legs beginning on June the 1st and ending on July the 11th. For those of you who have participated in the MREP program, which is the Marine Resource Education Program, the center will host a session of MREP 200 on March the 29th and 30th. And the GMRI, the Gulf of Maine Research Institute, is the lead organization for recruiting and signing up participants for MREP programs. News on the Delaware II. The Delaware II has been in service since 1968, and it will be decommissioned in the coming year. This is part of NOAA's attempt to consolidate the fleet and be more cost efficient. So in the when the Delaware goes away, we will be sharing the Pisces vessel, which is shared with the Southeast Fisheries Science Center. The Delaware II, in the before it is decommissioned, it will be conducting an ecosystem monitoring survey, two northern right whale surveys, mooring maintenance, and then its final schedule will end on May the 25th. The herring acoustics and deep water biodiversity surveys will be conducted by the Pisces, that's the new vessel that I just mentioned, and the surf clam and ocean quahog, and the apex predators survey will be transitioned over to industry vessel platforms. The ecosystem monitoring, the cetacean biology, and deep water coral projects are scheduled on the Henry Bigelow for the summer of 2012. For stock assessment information, the SARC that was just recently completed was number 53, and the stocks that were on the agenda were black sea bass and Gulf of Maine cod. And I'll be reporting in some detail on the assessment process and summarizing the final results of that meeting tomorrow morning. In addition to my normal presentation, Paul Rago is planning to join me, and he'll be here to help answer more technical questions that are more detailed about the assessment. The In addition to the SARC, which was just completed, the Science Center is currently doing the groundfish updates, the New England groundfish updates. I'm not exactly sure of the number, but it's somewhere around 12 and 13 stocks that are being updated, and there will be an integrated peer review of those stock assessment updates in Woods Hole at the Science Center the week of February the 13th through the 17th. In addition to that, at the national level, there are plans to organize a workshop to deal with the incorporation of MRIP data, and that's MRIP, the transition from MRFs to MRIP. And that workshop, I don't believe a date has been specifically set, but I've heard that it's still planned for some time in March. And one of the goals of that workshop will actually be to pin down how the data should be used in stock assessments, not to do it willy-nilly on a stock-by-stock basis, but to have some guidance on what are the kind of universal issues that are related to incorporating new recreational data into a stock assessment. And this will be more of a broad-scale workshop considering issues in different regions around the U.S. The track is also scheduled for this spring and summer with the shared stocks between the U.S. and Canada, the Eastern Georges Bank Cod, Eastern Georges Bank Haddock, and Georges Bank Yellowtail. Then, in addition, for the Mid-Atlantic Council, we have approximately 7 stock assessment updates that are being done this spring and will be delivered to the Council in June and July. And for both the New England groundfish updates and the Mid-Atlantic updates, we're doing an implementation of the new stock assessment process that I described to you at the last meeting. So these are integrated peer reviews. I described that at the last meeting, so I won't repeat that. For SARC 55, which is scheduled for November and December of 2012, 3 stocks on the agenda are the Atlantic Surf Clam, Georges Bank Cod, and White Hake. That completes my report. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Question for Jim. Jim.
Hey, Jim, maybe I don't know where it is, and maybe it's not out. Can you tell me when and where we can find the results of the fall survey that was conducted, or is it too early?
Yeah, I think that the results of the report that was always called the Fisherman's Report, that should be available from our fishery sampling branch. So contact Russ Brown or Wendy Gabriel.
Anyone else? Mark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jim, a lot has been made in terms of assessment criticisms about the conversion to the new vessel, the calibration coefficients to strata that can no longer be sampled anymore. Is that a decided issue, or is there additional work that's still ongoing relative to the calibration coefficients and consideration of the impacts of shallow water strata that can't be sampled?
Yeah, I think Paul Rago may be able to add to this, but my feeling is that they had the peer-reviewed workshop about a year ago where they used Tim Miller's model to develop calibration coefficients for many of the stocks. At that meeting and subsequently, there have been more analyses by Tim that have been able to advance those analyses so that they're length-based. And those are being utilized in stock assessments on a stock-by-stock basis as they come up. And in addition to these calibration coefficients, the state surveys that are conducted all the way from Maine down to North Carolina are starting to be utilized in the stock assessments. So they are covering these inshore strata. Russ Brown could probably also answer this quite well, and I'm really not, you know, I'm stretching to go much further than that.
Anyone else? Dave.
Yeah, Jim, just a clarification. You mentioned the surveys, inshore surveys along the coast, so obviously you're referencing NEMAP as well. Regarding the use of NEMAP in survey work, we do not yet, I don't think, and correct me if I'm wrong, we do not yet have any index of abundance for any species along the coast that is caught in the NEMAP survey. It's still premature as far as I understand. NEMAP is providing information for age and growth and biological samples, all of that, but not yet for indices of abundance. Am I correct on that? And do you know of any center plans to initiate begin the use of NEMAP for actual indices of abundance to assist out the assessments that are now done with Bigelow?
Yeah, you're correct that they have not actually been utilized yet as an index of abundance. However, the data have been plotted in at least a couple of the latest stock assessments from the Mid-Atlantic. So the working groups are considering the data and looking at it. However, the time series is still short for providing an index of abundance.
Anyone else? Okay, we'll move on to liaison to the Mid. Frank?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Mid-Atlantic Council met in Williamsburg mid-December. It was a joint meeting with the ASMFC. First was monkfish. The Council approved the final set of sub-goals and objectives for the future of the management of the monk fishery. Some objectives will be dealt with in frameworks, and others will be dealt with in Amendment 6. In the joint meeting, the Council dealt with harvest limits for fluke, scup, and sea bass. At their August meeting, they set the limits for the year. Since that time, there was an updated stock assessment, and which said summer flounder had been rebuilt, but it was also overestimated, and it was going to need a 26% reduction for the upcoming year. The harvest limit for recreational for 2012 was set at 8.76 million pounds. Most states can liberalize their regulations from the current year till next year or for the upcoming year. SCUP was set at 8.3 million, which is nearly double what it was last year. They adopted a 20 fish possession limit, 10.5 inches, and open year-round for federal waters. Sea bass was set at 1.32 million pounds and an option for opening up January and February. And that was basically the next meeting will be in 3 weeks in Virginia Beach. And on the agenda there is surf clam, an ocean quahog, tilefish, spiny dogfish, squid, mackerel, and butterfish, dealing with a framework. And that was basically about it. Any questions?
Any questions for Frank? Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, Frank, you mentioned spiny dogfish is on the agenda. Do you happen to know what the agenda items are?
I don't have them here, but I can probably get them. Oop, George.
I think it's Amendment 3, which was looking at a variety of different issues. I think, Mike, do you remember? Okay. So they're in early stages of development of that amendment.
Thank you very much. But the reason why I ask is I think it's a one-hour meeting. And I'm wondering whether I should go down there for a one-hour meeting, but since those are the topics, I better make my reservations. Okay.
Anyone else for Frank? Okay, I'm not going to blow it this time. Captain Nicola, Coast Guard.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Before I begin my briefing, I'd like to
make everyone aware of the presence of Commander Kurt Verkaitis, who's the CEO of Coast Guard Cutter Campbell. Campbell recently completed their home ported in Portsmouth Naval Shipyard over in Kittery, and he just finished a patrol up in D1 waters, so a lot of his work will be presenting in terms of boardings and violations and whatnot. And, of course, Mr. Paul Bassick from our Fishing Vessel Safety Shop is in the audience as well. From the enforcement side, 523 boardings conducted between 1 November and 30 January, with 7 violations issued, resulting in observed compliance rate of 98.6%. And on the safety side of those same 523 boardings, 205 violations issued to 95 vessels for a compliance rate of 81.8%. During that time period, the Coast Guard First District assets responded to 30 vessel casualties and 7 medevacs, including the grandson of one of our council members. 83 fishermen were assisted, and one fatality. And of the we also had 10 terminations during that time period. A couple of notable search and rescue cases that we had, the fishing vessel Elizabeth Helen, underscores the benefits of properly registering your EPIRB. The first 2 satellite passes didn't provide a position, we were able to take the VMS data based on the EPIRB registration data, and thanks to Bill Semrau's shop, we're able to get a position and launch assets immediately, as opposed to waiting for that third satellite pass that would have been about an hour and a half to 2 hours delay. We were able to respond right away. So certainly a good reason to have your EPIRB registration data updated if you don't have it. And also the fishing vessel Vincenzo, that case involved a vessel that failed its safety inspection back in December of 2010, corrected a number of discrepancies that were integral in getting the crew off as the vessel capsized. That underscores the value of those voluntary inspections. We were able to hold our gear stowage workshop on the 29th of November, down at the Fisheries Training Center at Otis Air Force Base on Cape Cod. I think a more detailed report will be forthcoming on Thursday. However, we had some great discussions, and as you can see from the photos, people were fairly well behaved. Rodney was able to lead us in a hands-on demonstration of using the mock-up of a trawler deck down at the Nerf Tech, and in the lower right-hand corner, we were able to, thanks to Terry Alexander, he volunteered the fishing vessel Joker to actually get out there and try this. What it is essentially is snow fence that you grab at Home Depot for about $20, and we were able to wrap it around a net reel, and it showed up very well. We were able to coordinate Joka's trip with an aircraft overflight, and took some pictures of it, and it worked out real well. So thanks to Terry and his crew, Captain Steve York, Darren Carlton, and Rod Harbison for a very successful field test. Unless there's any questions, that concludes my presentation, Mr. Chair.
Any questions for Captain Nicola? Dave.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to acknowledge and thank the Coast Guard. One of the rescues that they did was in Rhode Island, and it was the one with the EPIRB situation. It was a magnificent piece of work that the Coast Guard did. Picking that up on the second pass was critical to saving the life of the fisherman involved, who was a good friend of mine and a first-class operator, and I would like to just acknowledge that and thank the Coast Guard for a magnificent job.
Thanks, Dave, and again, Bill Semrau's shop as well for their integral role in that. Thank you.
Anyone else? Okay, thank you. We will move on to enforcement and VMS.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll just go over some brief topics.
During the period of January 1st through the 26th, the Office of Law Enforcement documented 93 incidents. From those 93 incidents, 39 of those became cases, or 42%, and the rest were, other than seven that are still undetermined as to whether they will be cases or not, have been closed. In Rhode Island this past week, Richard Wetherell pled guilty to observer harassment and assault. His sentencing is scheduled for April 20th in 2012. Initially, he went for a plea a couple of months ago and ended up not pleading, and then he ended up pleading on January 27th. Again, these are pretty important cases. I've mentioned this at the last council meeting. I've mentioned it at Mid-Atlantic council meetings in Atlantic states. Observer harassment and assault is really intolerable, and we will be enforcing these at every turn. Some other activities. We have a management system that tracks other activities as well, not just investigations, but all of our activities. During that same time period, we had 32 outreach events documented, and four were with NIMFS, and three we provided training to industry members. In December, Maine fishing vessels were charged in a criminal complaint for conspiring to land overages of sea scallops in New Jersey. I have a copy of the criminal complaint here. I'll leave it over on the table if anybody would like to read it. But basically, it involves DC Air and Seafood conspiring with commercial fishermen to land overages of scallops in the general category fishery. I don't know when that case is scheduled for trial or if it's going to go to trial. All the information I have is pretty much in this criminal complaint, and it's available for anyone. It's on the internet too. It's a common open source information, so anybody can get it. Also available is the NOAA Fisheries Navigator, where it discusses our efforts on seafood fraud. We continue to think that this is a very important priority for us. Not only does it protect the domestic fisheries by combating the undercutting of domestic product and product substitution, but it also helps other countries enforce their own laws. And it's a huge economic battle. So we appreciate everybody's support and our continued efforts in that. That pretty much concludes my report, and I'll turn it over to Bill for VMS.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and council members. I'm Bill Semro, the Northeast VMS Program Manager in the NOAA Office of Law Enforcement. The Northeast VMS team is monitoring 1,025 active vessels. We have another 134 vessels that are on a letter of exemption power down. In the groundfish fishery, we're monitoring 368 sector vessels and 114 common pool vessels. Just to add to something that Captain DeCola mentioned regarding the capsizing of the Vincenzo and the Elizabeth Helen, there was a third, both those, were, of course, were VMS vessels. There was a third VMS vessel that we lost as well down in the 5th Coast Guard District AOR, and that was the Mandy Ness that was sailing out of Barnegat Light. And the captain of that particular vessel was a fatality, unfortunately. That was three vessels that went down in a period of 4 days, between, I believe it was the 7th of January and the 10th of January. Very unfortunate. There is a VMS software change coming in March in support of Scallop Framework 23. The change will involve the Scallop Declaration page only. The specifications for this change were sent to the Northeast VMS vendors yesterday. All Northeast vessel owners will be required to upgrade their onboard VMS unit software to comply with this regulatory action. We will be asking SkyMate and Tron owners to send a test declaration once they've loaded the new software. This is new, but the reason for that is this simple procedure is to allow us to know that the owner is, in fact, compliant with the software upgrade. It's difficult to tell until they've made that first declaration. Those wishing to monitor the status of the software change can do so by going to the Northeast VMS webpage on the NERO website, which is found under the Resources tab labeled Seafood Dealers and Fishing Industry. Or you can type in your web browser, www.nero.noaa.gov, /NERO/VMS. Last week, a relatively rare event occurred. The table in our monitoring system went down that correlates every vessel position to those areas that that position is within. So you can imagine there are millions of data files within that table. We often refer to this feature as geocoding or georeferencing in our VTRAC system. When this occurred, the system had no reference for the VMS demarcation line or the Northeast fishery. And as a result, our trip generator ended the trips for all vessels at sea within the fishery. We started getting calls and emails from fishermen at sea wondering why their trips ended. We shut down trip generation and trip notification emails, and we sent those 200 vessels an email to disregard those incorrect trip end emails. We alerted our headquarters data center. This was not a Northeast alone issue. This was a broad VMS monitoring system issue. And we alerted the data center, and the problem has since been corrected. Over the next few days, we'll be working with our VMS contractor to regenerate the bad trips in the system and restart our trip generation and email notification programs. We know that VMS data in this region is used not only for enforcement and compliance, but also relied upon by the region for their data collection and management purposes. So we coordinate daily with the regional staffs to ensure that accurate and timely VMS data is collected and available. As always, we continue to pay very close attention to any and all closed area incursions. We've sent several incidents directly to the NIMS agents over the past few months. I have a standing policy with my team that they provide me with any closed area detections, regardless of the incursion distance. Each are evaluated, and those deemed appropriate are sent on to an agent. The majority of the incursions of late have occurred in the Western Gulf of Maine closed area, by the way. We often see confusion among industry when declaring into the U.S.-Canada management area. There are 7 area combinations available on the multi-species declaration screen for those declaring into the eastern U.S.-Canada area, and there's a single declaration for the western U.S.-Canada area. Those that are familiar with the declaration screen, you know, the sub-areas that apply to VMS are for the eastern area are areas 1, 2, 3, 5, 6, 7, and 8, and area 4 is the western area. I just want to remind industry that the VMS team is always ready to help anyone who has questions about declaring into the eastern area. And a description of those 8 areas for the U.S.-Canada management area and declaration guidance can be found in the VMS operator instructions on the VMS webpage. Finally, we continue to send advance notice of area closures via VMS fleet message notification to help industry remain compliant. Last week, we sent notice through VMS of tonight's closure of the closed area 1 hook gear haddock sap and the closed area 2 haddock sap. And that completes my report, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Terry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not a question, but a comment for Logan. And I want to thank you and OLE and General Counsel for moving ahead the DC Air complaint. I know it's taken a lot of time and a lot of work, but your efforts have really greatly assisted Maine Marine Patrol's efforts to maintain compliance with the number of Downeast fisheries, and we really appreciate it.
Dave Gaisel.
Bill, I had a question, and have to pardon me. I've been on vacation. I just got back, so I've been gone for a while. SkyMate told us that they were, not them, but their satellite provider was supposed to be launching a satellite or maybe more in early January to resolve this issue of you know, very little availability of satellites. Do you know if that's been done?
I haven't gotten any word, Dave, that that's been done. I doubt it, but I will look into it, and I'll get back to you on that. I know that that launch had been delayed. You're talking about the Orbcomm, you know, satellites. Yeah. By the way, I will also mention that you do have an email from me that I sent. I know you've been away. I heard the other day, but there is an email from me about a couple of recent VMS issues that I wanted to advise you of because I know you've got.
Yeah, I read them and I appreciate it. And I, you know, I do want to actually make a comment about that. That was going to be my second comment. Is that it? You know, it is refreshing to me, and I think Bill's team should be applauded that when something occurs, it's a mistake basically, and we all make mistakes. That they have acknowledged it, sent people basically an apology and said, we're sorry that this, you know, this software we're testing keeps escaping the building and sending you erroneous messages. And I think the second email you sent me said that this time it's been destroyed. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
So hopefully it won't make any more escapes. It's been tamed permanently. But, it, you know, I think it warrants you know, people knowing that you know, fishermen have been notified that a mistake was made, and because people become very concerned. I mean, they get a thing that says you're in violation, and they panic. And it's appreciative. You know, I wanted to put it on the record. Thank you.
If I may, I just want to briefly describe what Dave is talking about. I didn't mention that particular topic in my brief, but the SFD, Sustainable Fisheries, came to me some weeks back and asked that we send a VMS fleet-wide message out, well, actually a message specifically to a group of vessels that were not in compliance with their VTRs. And we did that, and that message went to the correct VMS addresses. However, we also sent that same VTR noncompliance email to the secondary email addresses in our system, which are the internet addresses of the owners. It's a voluntary program if you want to get your trip emails, you know, to your home internet address. In addition to the vessel's address, we can do that. So we sent that same VTR noncompliance, or attempted to the secondary email addresses for those vessels out of compliance, and something happened with the program, and it sent out that VTR noncompliance to several owners' secondary addresses that were in compliance, or, you know, that it wasn't meant to go to. That was clearly, you know, an error on our part, and we sent out an apology about that. So that we try to obviously avoid those things because we know it causes confusion and inconvenience. So, thank you.
David Pierce.
Logan, I believe you mentioned there were 93 violations of VTR. With about 46%, 46 actually being cases to be pursued. Am I correct with those numbers? And if indeed I am correct, what were the nature of those VTR violations? Did they include false reporting?
They're not VTR violations. There are 93 incidents. Basically, when I'm talking about incidents, I'm talking about any complaint we receive, any boarding we undertake, any inspection we do at a dealership. Those are incidents. So of those incidents, and the majority of these cases, we had a border operation in Maine checking the border for lobster coming across the border from Canada into Maine, and the majority of those cases were those cases. They were not trip reporting. None of these were trip reporting violations.
Yeah. To what extent does enforcement pursue that question, that is, to what extent are fishermen reporting properly through VTRs? How that's being monitored, I assume, for the purposes of tracking compliance. So to what extent, if you could answer that?
Well, that has changed over the years, but we basically work closely with SFD and the statistics office to find out where the gaps are. If there are vessels that aren't reporting that we are aware of, we try to mitigate that through outreach and education and to get them to comply. The same thing with dealers, dealer reporting. The basic reporting requirements for vessels, obviously they have to have their trip report completed prior to returning to the dock. The majority of those types of incidents that are encountered are handled with a community-oriented policing approach where we educate them and say, look, you really need to have these done. They need to be turned in on time. We let them know what the issue is. There have been violations issued in the past. I don't have any specific numbers on that. I could probably get you some if you'd like. But the majority of those are handled with what's a summary settlement or a written warning, basically. You get I think the summary settlement schedule for trip reports is $250 penalty. Now, false reporting is a totally different situation where if it's intentional, if it's egregious, that's a totally different set of circumstances. But, you know, misreporting or accidental missing of species, things like that, we try to handle with education and impress upon the fishermen that it is important that the reporting is done on time and correctly.
Anyone else? Thank you. Rich?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Rich Rue with the American Bluefin Tuna Association. While you're on the subject of enforcement, a few weeks back, earlier in January, there was a bit of publicity, newspaper reports and others about midwater trawlers actively fishing in off the Rhode Island coastline, maybe even in and out of the three-mile territorial sea, and that there was quite a bit of interaction with bluefin tuna. I believe the state of Rhode Island got involved in it with a letter, and the initial concerns were raised primarily by striped bass fishermen and bluefin tuna fishermen who were very concerned. I think a little later on, maybe some of the lobster fishermen got involved. And there was a whole question about whether or not the activity that was taking place by the midwater trawlers was legal or not. We got involved in asking NIMS for a response as to, could you clarify the situation? Is this all according to regulations, and is it on the up and up? There was even a report which we wanted to clarify to make sure it wasn't just anecdotal, that the observer had allowed the crew to actually cut up and eat one of the bluefin and pack some coolers and take some of it home. So I'm just wondering if between Dave or anybody else from NIMS or Rhode Island could clarify. I'd like to be able to clarify to the bluefin public whether or not there's any truth to that activity, that the midwater trawlers were fishing in state waters for herring and having an interaction with large, medium, and giant bluefin that are still in the area. Thanks.
Logan, are you aware of, do you have any information on that?
I have not received any complaint regarding that. That is news to me. I have not. Those complaints never came across my desk. I don't know who in NIMS was contacted, but it wasn't me in particular. I could reach out to our Rhode Island, you know, the folks that work in Rhode Island and see if they were contacted, but it was never raised to my attention.
Thank you. That was my next mark.
Yeah, we heard that story. I've seen no reports or evidence from our enforcement division regarding bluefin tuna interactions or, frankly, any other species interactions. There's been a small amount of river herring documented. We have a significant number of vessels fishing in state waters on a body of herring that is quite close to shore. It has been for some time. But the problems that I'm aware of are unrelated to bluefin tuna or other species. They're related to gear conflicts, interaction with local boats, failure to call, some regulatory violations, failure to call in on a daily basis, failure to have a proper license on board or a vessel declaration, commercial declaration sticker, things like that.
Thank you. Anyone else on that? Okay, we'll move on to ASMFC. We don't have a representative here.
What? Commission doesn't meet till next week.
Okay. We'll move on then to John Weber, NROC.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I will be brief. Paul took a bunch of my thunder previously. A couple quick updates for you. First, as Paul mentioned, we have been working with Paul and some other folks to put together our regional workshop. You heard the dates, March 12th and 13th. Invitations to that will be coming from me to all of you, plus other folks in the room as well, plus about 200 other people across New England. Today, tonight, perhaps late tomorrow morning. So look for that, and if you have any questions with that, please feel free to contact me. The general overall goal of this workshop will be to dive more deeply into the Northeast Regional Ocean Council's work plan for the upcoming year or two. So it's a real opportunity to help shape the work that we do going forward. We have already begun some of that conversation. As some of you know, we have been convened a phone call with some members of the council, the state agency folks in particular, to start thinking in more detail about some of the commercial fishing characterization work that we want to do. Thank you very much to those folks who participated in that call. Coming out of that call were several pieces of homework for me and folks I work with. We're working with that, and we'll be back to you in very short order. On both of those, special thanks to Paul for being part of this with everything else going on. Very much appreciate his attention to this as we've been moving forward. So there will be more to come on that, and certainly this will be an item that we will talk about at the March 12th and 13th workshop as well. And then my final update, I told you this was going to be brief. Paul also mentioned that we were actually very happy to hear that the national level, the National Ocean Council, we think heard us loud and clear and said that Fishery Management Council should be a formal part of this regional planning body process moving forward. We're happy to hear that. We've also been suggesting to them that for our work here in the Northeast anyway, it also makes sense for there to be other ways to interact with the council, some of which are examples of which I've just provided, working with folks on scoping some of our work, et cetera. And so we're happy to hear that they may that may have rang through. That said, obviously there are details to work out as all this moves ahead. The latest that we have heard is that the letters may be coming from the National Ocean Council to the states asking for their nominees for the regional planning body, perhaps about the third week of February. So if that is the case, what that means is that other part of the conversation will really kick into gear if that happens. We have heard this now several times from the National Ocean Council, so that's an if. And that is all that I wanted to share with you today, but happy to answer any questions either now or I will be staying around for the day.
Thank you. Questions for John? Sally?
Yeah, quick question. So since the guidance says that a representative from the Fishery Council needs to be someone who works for a state agency or National Marine Fisheries Service, I guess I assume that the council will send someone who works for one of the state agencies, maybe someone who's on the executive committee. But how do you expect, maybe you don't know the answer to this, but how do you expect the states are going to sort out their own membership if, say, they want to have their director of fisheries serve on NROC? And that person might come from here. Is that something that we'll just have to sort out and kind of work our way down the list, so to speak?
I think mostly the latter, and honestly, I think that you know, part of that conversation will be up to the governors and the conversations within their cabinets as to how they wish to handle that. I don't think that you know, NROC is certainly not going to weigh in and say it should be thus or though or this or that way. It's going to be up to the individual states.
Anyone else? Thank you, John. That concludes the report section. We will take a break, and why don't we come back 11 o'clock. We'll resume. Thank you. And we're going to resume with the Essential Fish Habitat Omnibus Amendment. We don't have anything under EFPs.